Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show with CamaPlan founder Carl Fisher on tax-free real estate investing through self-directed IRAs. I am Dan Breslin, host of the REI Diamond Show. Today's guest, Carl Fisher, is the founder of CamaPlan, an IRA company specializing in self-directed IRA and other retirement, investment, education, and health savings accounts. In this episode, Carl and I discuss self-directed IRAs and how to buy, hold, and sell real estate using your IRA account. We also discuss methods that many passive investors are using to fund other real estate investors' projects to produce 8, 10, and even 12% returns while never touching a hammer, signing a deed, or even attending a settlement. In fact, many of these private lender deals are done by people living in a completely different state than where the actual investment property is located and often never even see the property. For example, I placed my dad's IRA capital in the projects of my real estate investor friends, and my dad has never even seen a single property that he's invested in. CamaPlan is the IRA administrator of my dad's retirement account, and also for my daughter's self-directed college savings plan. Did you catch that? I'm actually flipping deals and setting aside tax-free profits to pay for my daughter's college tuition and expenses. Carl and I are going to cover all of that and more, so if you have not done so already, grab a seat, shut off the email and all other distractions, grab a pen and pad for taking notes, and strap in for a content-packed episode on tax-free real estate investing.
Welcome to the show, Carl.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You got it. So, you know, the question that always is burning on everybody's mind is, you know, who is Carl and how did you get here in the real estate industry? If you could give us a little background about your business and kind of the path you took to get to where you're at, you know, as a provider for the real estate community.
Thanks a lot for giving me that opportunity, Dan. And I guess, you know, I've listened to several of the other people's interviews that you've had. And by the way, I think they're great. And I think you have great guests. And I'm humbled to be among them. But the way I got into business or real estate business is I was born into it. My grandparents on both sides of my family were in real estate. My mom and dad were in real estate. And they would talk about their properties at the dinner table. So As I said, I grew up on it. It was just one of the staples in the house. Then we went to college. When I was in college, I was kind of the guy that was looking for the houses. You know, when we moved off campus or was trying to move off campus, I would also rent houses up in Killington and other ski areas in the wintertime. And by going and renting them, and then I'd rent them to, you know, 10 friends and basically be able to stay there without
nice.
Paying. So, you know, I just been around real estate, liked it. It was part of my blood, basically. I read the book Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and it kind of helped me understand why some people rent. And I, you know, so I got the other side of that. So it's kind of interesting when I talk to different people on how they move from one side of the renting to the owning and then owning versus renting aspects of it. So being there, my dad developed a lot of property, built apartment buildings, you know, probably had over 100 units at one point, maybe 200, I don't even know. I went off to college and I come from a pretty large family. I'm the oldest of 12 kids and every one of them are into real estate in some aspect of it from an investment standpoint. But, you know, that'll segue me into kind of how I got into the self-directed IRA business is when my dad died, he died land rich and cash poor. And he had some loans out there that had matured and were in a high penalty rate at like 24%, I think it was. I went online, or not online, but went in the newspapers. This was back in 1993, really, before the internet came about. And I found someone who was lending money. I talked to him. there wasn't any mortgage on a property, so I mortgaged one of the properties my dad had and borrowed the money, paid off the matured loan, and then after about a year, I was able to borrow money from a bank on this, and I got the rate from 24% to 12%. But meanwhile, while I'm paying it, I'm making it to the IRA. I said, well, this is kind of interesting. And I called the guy up and the client up, or who wasn't a client, but someone who was using an IRA. And I called him up and I said, I would like to reduce my rate from 12 to 7. That's what the bank will give me. And he says, why would I take 7? I can get 12 all day long. And you see how secure it is, you know. And he had a 30% loan to value. So I said to myself, I was launching rockets at the Space Center at that time. I said, well, this is a lot better deal than my 401k, and I don't have to go to work for it. So I refinanced, you know, through the bank at 7%, paid off the loan, and then I went back and I called the bank that was doing this, and I asked them about it. First, they pretended like they didn't know me, but they'd been taking my check for 12 months, you know, so... I asked them, I said, how do you do this with your IRA? And they said, you don't have enough money. And I said, well, you didn't even ask me how much money I had. And they said, well, you don't have an account here. Please don't call back. So then I tried to find out more information. There wasn't that much out there. There weren't any books on it. I actually went right to the IRS and I said, look, this guy's doing this and I'm trying to find out about it. People at the IRS didn't know about it. One person told me that it was illegal and that there's nothing on it. And I said, Well, they're doing it, and they're doing it at the bank. Then I got another person at the IRS, and they said, yes, let me get a supervisor. And I heard the supervisor and her talking in the back, and they said, yeah, there's something like that, but get his phone number and call him back, and we have to look up the details of it. And then I just didn't feel like giving the IRS my phone number at that point in time. But then what happened is the internet was coming up then, you know, it was the old dial-in and, you know, the crackling and all the bells and whistles, and, you know, it took like a minute and a half to connect. But I started finding out a little bit of information back in 93 and 95 on it. And, you know, then I started figuring out and I was looking at it and, you know, finally pulled the trigger. And, you know, like I said, I come from a big family, so I told my family about it. I've got a pretty big sphere of influence, so I told a lot of other people about it. And then finally they said, why don't you start a business? We trust you more than we do any of these other companies. And 2003, I started the business of self-direction with my sister, who was very good with software. She was an IT consultant at the time, so she was working on our website and back office trust software. And that's kind of how we got started. I don't know. Nice. If I was too long-winded or not.
No, right on point. So let's let all the listeners know, they might be kind of, what exactly is the specialty? So you're the founder of Camma Plan, right?
Correct.
You guys specialize mostly in what type of IRAs and, you know, what's the big niche here? Why is this real important for real estate investors?
Well, it's real important for real estate investors because, as I said, when I found out that I could actually take my IRA or my 401k and buy a piece of property with it or give a loan like I was given and collect the interest and not pay taxes on it, basically have that money tax-free. And then in 1998, when the Roth IRA came out, right, knowing that all that money I was going to make was going to be tax-free, and then building tax-free income for my life and my kids and maybe my grandkids, depending on how it goes. So that was very important, but we opened it up because we were using it. We found out about it. It was way better to me than 1031s. It was the best way to save taxes that I ever found, and I knew all of the real estate loopholes and depreciation and all those rules, et cetera, associated with real estate. This was just so much better, and the record keeping didn't need to be as accurate, and it saved me time and money from that aspect of it. But yeah, our company will do, you know, solo 401ks, Roth IRAs, traditional IRAs, business IRAs such as SEPs and Simples. And then my favorite one is the health savings account. It was really good 2 years ago. It was still good last year. I don't know what Obamacare is going to do to it in the future. But that's the only investment that you can put in real estate, and the money you put in is deducted, and the money you take out for health care is tax-free. So basically, you can pay your health care for the rest of your life with an apartment building and the rent that comes off of it, or until you get Social Security or Medicare. It's like a no-brainer to me to be able to use real estate or notes or mortgages or tax liens to pay for my health care.
This is interesting. So you and I, we're both pros in the game, Carl. We know exactly what. I know what you're talking about. You know what I'm asking about. But like a lot of times, I'll give you an idea, a little story. When I raise money for my own deals and I talk with somebody who's, relatively new in the business or even been in the real estate, investment arena for some time, but just hasn't heard specifically of the self-directed IRA, there's some confusion. So a lot of people are like, wait, what? I could buy with the IRA. And right away, their mind is going to, borrowing against the IRA, like leaving the IRA wherever it is and borrowing money or taking a loan, like in some fashion. But a lot of times, like what they're thinking is not the same thing that you and I are talking about. So do you think we can kind of like delve into exactly what the self-directed IRA, what's going on there? It's the IRA that actually owns the property. It's like the same way the money would be sitting in Vanguard and invested in stocks. It's now sitting in you with the custodian. Can we just kind of like, tell like a story or put that in layman's terms so that we can kind of explain that to somebody who's never heard of a self-directed IRA and buying real estate?
Yeah, I think that's a great question for me. And I appreciate it, you asking it. And just to add to the confusion, there are companies out there, and most of them will give you a self-directed IRA, but the only thing you can self-direct it in is what they sell, okay? So it's not what we call a truly self-directed IRA. Sure, you can pick your stocks, bonds, and mutual funds as you see fit in those accounts, but you can't buy things like real estate. You can't lend money because Schwab, TD, Fidelity, Vanguard aren't going to allow you to do that unless you have millions and millions of dollars with them, and then they're going to probably put you with another broker-dealer. But if you remember, like Mitt Romney, when he was running for president, they released his financials, and his IRA had $100 million in it. And everybody goes, Nice. Well, how did he do that? What did he put into it? And everybody's calling us and saying, hey, can you give me one of those Mitt Romney IRAs? I said, yes, we can, but you have to pick your investments. So let's kind of go through it, and I'll try to make it simple. Right now, most people put cash into their IRAs, and then their stockbroker buys stock with them. With us, you put money in your IRA, and then we don't sell anything, so we basically let anybody buy what they want, and we recommend they buy what they know and understand. So if you're already in the real estate business like I was, it was very simple to say, okay, now I can do that. I can actually buy a house, and when I read my statement, it'll say a single-family house in Philadelphia, PA. Then my IRA will rent the house out, or we'll have a realtor rent the house out, and then all the rent payments come into my IRA, just like it used to be a stock, right? It used to be IBM stock, and IBM dividends would come into it. The house is the exact same thing, but I have more control over what I'm buying. I can buy a house. I can buy a piece of land. I can buy a condo, an apartment building, something down the Jersey Shore, a condo in San Diego, whatever I choose, a grocery store in Texas. It doesn't matter. Whatever I want, the house next door. But those are just, they show up on the statement, right? Just like stocks, bonds, and mutual funds show up on a Vanguard or Fidelity statement. On the CAMA statement, most of the people buy real estate or lend money, turn their IRAs into mini banks, or they buy into private businesses, or they buy gold and silver, tax liens. Some people have bought racehorses. There's a wide variety of what can be put into a truly self-directed IRA. Does that make it any more clear, Dan?
Yeah, I think so. And I know there's people that are going to be listening to it right at this moment. Their mind is having like a dissociative disconnect. They're thinking, wait a minute, I remember it took me, I was kind of young when I learned about it, and I really didn't have any assets or anything at the time. I remember it took me, a few days before it finally sunk in, and then like the light bulb went off. And I know some people have the light bulb right now going off like, whoa, this is nuts. So let's talk about maybe first, before we get into some of the exact how-tos that we definitely need to get into, let's talk about what IRAs can be rolled over to be self-directed, because there's like circumstances behind that. Like I know that like one of my lenders had recently left her job, and she came to me because she's interested in putting the IRA that was with her old job to work in one of my construction projects, but she was only able to do that because she had left that employer. So could we just like talk about that a little bit as far as like what IRAs might qualify or what IRAs might not qualify before we move on?
Sure. Any IRA, a Roth IRA, a traditional IRA, a SEP IRA, a simple IRA, a custodian IRA, all of those can be rolled to self-direction at any time, whether they're still working with the company or not. Now, if you have an old 401k with a company, and you're still working there, you may or may not be able to roll that over. In a lot of cases, you can't. If you separate from service, as you had talked about, or the company sells to another company, those are possibilities at that time. You can roll an old 401k or an existing 401k into an IRA at that point and then self-direct it. HSAs, educational savings accounts, those can be rolled to self-directed IRAs. Thrift saving plans are same as 401ks. They may or may not be able to do it without a special incident such as separation from service, retirement, etc. Now, 529 plans cannot be self-directed, and most other plans. Those are the primary plans that can be self-directed. And when I say that, again, just keep thinking that all the rules are exactly the same in the IRS code. The only thing that changes is the asset on your statement. In one instance, in the traditional manner, it says, mutual fund. In the CAMA plan or self-directed arena, it's going to say a note, a house, a private placement, or gold. So it's, again, nothing changes except the asset in the account. You put cash into the account, you buy a mutual fund, or you put cash in the account and you buy a house. It makes no difference. They both are there for investment purposes. You can't use the house to live in. It has to be an investment, just like the stocks and bonds are investments going forward. So I think that kind of lets you know the IRAs and 401ks that are there. There are obviously Roth components, and these are changing all the time. Roth IRAs can be done that way. There's Roth components of 401ks that came about back in 2010. Those can be self-directed. And if your company doesn't allow you to self-direct them now, you can ask them if they'll give you that capability. Some do and some don't. And you can also ask them if they give you the Roth or the tax-free portion as well as the tax-deferred portion of these accounts. And these are very important if you're going to be doing real estate, because once you get enough real estate providing you enough income to live on, then the rest of it is a lot nicer to be doing in a tax-free or tax-deferred account. In my case, I think it's like a 40% savings that I see compared to, having real estate on the outside. So, on my Roth IRA real estate, I'm making 40% more than I am on a piece of real estate that isn't in my Roth today, just because of the tax consequences. That's pretty significant in my world.
Can you give me a few examples of the type of assets that you personally, seek out, hold, maybe still actively pursue now, Carl?
Well, I'm getting up there in age and I'm kind of slowing down on the real estate. I still hold the real estate because I can't really give it up in my mind. I have no idea what the economy is going to be doing, but I love real estate. I think it's the oldest asset in the world because people have always used land either to work on or to live in or pray in or party in. So I just never see that disappearing. Even if money disappears, people still need a place to live and work or farm. So I like real estate. I try to stay in real estate. I look for great deals nowadays. I try not to do deals that are less than $500,000 because it takes me the same amount of time to do a $500,000 deal as it does to do a, you know, $50,000 deal, you know, unless it just falls into my lap. But, you know, I wasn't always like that. You know, back in the day, I was happy to make, you know, $15,000 on places, but $15,000 went a lot further too. So, you know, I do that. I also invest in tax liens, and I do some private lending to people that I've worked with over the years.
I'm going to go back just a few pieces of topic here, and I just caused that small tangent a little bit. So from your description, if we have, you know, in layman's terms, we have someone who's working, you know, at whatever, Vanguard, and they have their money in the Vanguard IRA, and the Vanguard IRA purchases assets, simply put, and they're buying stocks. So then we take on the other side of the table is the self-directed IRA, like if they rolled the money over into the self-directed IRA, and then the self-directed IRA is allowed and is going to buy assets. It can be stocks or it could be real estate or anything else that's on the qualified list of investments, to put simply. And I'm kind of running through some pros and cons here because there's probably some people that maybe are listening who are thinking, oh, you know, this is going to be simple. They're so used to having such a super passive role in their investments that, you know, they may want to be warned about like the pros and cons of the self-directed IRA just from, you know, what we're talking about now. Some of the pros are, hey, maybe I'll find a guy like, you know, myself. I'm paying 12% interest to people's IRA. That's probably better than a lot of our listeners are even getting on their own super passive IRA investments. But then on the flip side of that, Carl, I'm kind of seeing like the cons of the self-directed IRA, which we haven't really talked about, but I think would be important, would be the management and the choosing of the assets and, you know, having to collect on the mortgage payments, et cetera. To what level of involvement does CAMA take in the management of the asset, if any at all? And I kind of know the answer to this. I'm just asking this question so people know what they're signing on for as they decide to self-direct their IRA and what responsibilities they better plan to make sure are being covered before they put their money in a self-direct.
Great, great points there that you mentioned, Dan. First thing is the IRS doesn't give you a list of qualified investments. All they do is tell you what you cannot invest in. It's a pretty short list. It's primarily life insurance and collectibles and alcohol. When I say collectibles, it's like antiques or stamps or anything that's got a collectible adjective in front of it. They're jewelry, things like that. So the list of what you can't invest in is very, very limited. But let's talk about some of the pros and cons, like you said. If you don't know what you're investing in, I think that that's a con. If you do know it, like I grew up around real estate, and I don't care what it is, it doesn't matter. Stocks, bonds, and mutual funds are the same way. If you don't know what you're investing in, then you're using hope as a strategy. You're going to put your money over here, and based on the information that's been put out there by stockbrokers, the stock market always goes up, but so does inflation. So you put your money in there, and you hope you've got something at the end. Other people that are good at things or know a new business that's starting, they might want to put their money in that. So understanding your investment is very, very important. You've got to also understand that there's scammers out there. Bernie Madoff used IRA money and took some money from people that were investing with him, private investments through Bernie Madoff. None of our clients, to my knowledge, were in that category. But we do a lot of education online and in person in our classes to make sure people understand what they need to know. There's also a lot of other organizations out there. There's a lot of people that can listen to your interviews with different individuals. I know you had Dave Van Horn on there earlier talking about the note company, if you're talking about buying notes. So they need to get educated when they're investing with us. We don't do much of the management at all. We have clients in 41 states. There's no way I can say that the real estate down the Jersey Shore is the same as it is in Ohio or Missouri. So everybody has to know their own market. We basically do the paperwork. Our fees are minimal. It's, you know, $275 a year for an asset. So you can't expect us to be doing any management of it. Everything we do is at the direction of the individual client. So that client has to tell us what to do. If they want us to do a note, they negotiate the terms, the payback, the interest rate, all of that information, and then we sign it on their behalf after they tell us to and agree to the documentation. So if I am lending money, I sit down with the borrower and go through the whole note, and we write it up and then have the lawyers look it over and put the legalese in there, and then go record it at the courthouse with a mortgage on a property. So I think you want to have a team with you if you're going to do that. Know what you're investing in, know who you're investing in, know the exit strategy. We have a lot of things on our website at camaplan.com. If you're lending money, you know, the checklist that you should at least know and understand before you do any lending. And we tell people, if you haven't looked at this list, look at it. If you don't understand everything on there, you need to get answers for it just so that you know. So education is probably key in a lot of this information to keep you away from scammers. And if you look at the FBI's website and other scams that are out there, they do try to go after people with self-directed IRAs. But again, most people will know the people that they're doing it from a club that they belong to, a golf club or a country club or one of the real estate investor clubs in their area. They can go and find out, you know, more about the people they're dealing with. And that's what we recommend. So to answer your question succinctly, CamaPlan does very little except for reporting to the IRS, maintaining the copy of the documents as required by the IRS, and providing you statements. Hopefully that answered your question, unless I missed something in there.
Yeah, succinctly answered the question. I appreciate that. And it sounded to me like, you know, the real pro the real bottom line here of all this is that you really have to trust the individual or the company that you are placing your IRA monies in an investment with. I guess that would go for even investing in a stock or any other thing. And one of the big things, like one of my metaphors or one of my little, you know, wise sayings I picked up somewhere along the line is that if you're going to be in business with this person for however long the duration of the investment lasts. So if there's a 12-month note from an IRA to another individual, you better trust that person that you're going to be in business with. And like one of the things I always say, Carl, is that, you know, my business partners, any one of my business partners that I've chosen to do business with, if I leave them and I'm not at the $500,000 deal point yet, so just bear with me, the numbers mean more to me at 20,000 or 15 grand, but if I have $20,000 of my money on nothing more than a handshake in one of my business partners' account, and that business partner is heading out of the country for 10 or 15 days to go on vacation, I better not lose any sleep at night as a result of the level of trust I have in those individuals. And that's the kind of people that I do business with, is people that I can trust, you know, to that level. Because, you know, I know from experience that if you have your IRA money, you know, 100, 200 grand, you know, 20%, 30%, 100% of your retirement money, whatever it adds up to, invested in another individual's deal, if you have a comfort level and a trust with them, you know that everything's going well, they answer the phone, they pick up, they call you back, they keep the communication line open, you feel like things are going well, you're not going to worry as much. But if that individual is somebody you don't know, you know, you may have to deal with fears and doubts. And next thing you know, you're waking up in the middle of the night wondering what's going on. So I don't know. For me, it's just really all boils down to, do I trust this person enough to place money in their care? Because that's not something that the self-directed custodian, that's not something that you guys are doing. It's vetting borrowers and, you know, putting the legalese in there and choosing the investments for them. That's completely on the individual who's directing the IRA. Right, Carl?
Yeah, you bring up some good points, and I think trust is very important from that aspect. But what's even more important, you know, where I alluded to having people on the team, is I don't believe you should, you know, put money into a deal unless you got it secured, you know, by the correct paperwork. And I can give you an example. We have a client. He lent money to someone, you know, $50,000 on a piece of property worth $90,000. He put a note and a mortgage on it, recorded it. 6 years later, the guy can't make the payments on it and is going to give him a deed in lieu for the property. So he lent him the $50,000, made payments for, 4 years, was lax on the last year and missed some payments in there. And now he's given the property over. And the borrower, the IRA, as an example, is going to end up with the piece of property in the name of the IRA. And the IRA is now going to sell it and probably do it quickly. And the property's worth $90,000, so he's going to pick up $40,000. And people say to me, well, why didn't he just sell it himself? Well, he's got health problems and he's got other bigger buildings and he just doesn't want the headache of these. He actually has two houses and I think they're both under $100,000 and he just wants to offload them and not put out any more money after it. So, I mean, you see those deals going down and it's good to trust the people, but I always look at it and say, write it down, verify it, record it, secure it, because you never know when this guy's going to step out in front of a bus, and then what are you going to do? You're going to agree with his family what's going to be done, et cetera. If it's all written out and it's nice and clear, then you don't have those battles, and it does make you sleep nice and easy. And if it's that way, it's very easy to say to an attorney, hey, this guy isn't paying me. Please go collect it or foreclose on the property, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so would that be, this client here, and let's dig into this example a little bit. Would this be kind of an example of using the IRA like a mini bank so that the IRA's originating loans? Is that kind of what he was doing there, Carl?
That was exactly what he did. This was an investor that he knew and it had seen his work and the guy was good and he lent the money basically, 60% or less loan to value. So I thought that was pretty good. I forget what interest rate I think he was at. I think it was like 10%, back in the day where interest rates were still high, before they went down to where they are today. I guess it was back in 2008 when they went down. So he had a 10% loan and the guy's been paying it off, since back in that time frame. And his IRA went in there. CAMA plan for the benefit of John's IRA was what the note was made out for, and the mortgage was put on there, and it was recorded, in the county courthouse, and the payments were coming into the IRA nice and good for the first, 4 or 5 years. And then the last year, he was missing every other one or, got one out of 3 months, and finally the guy said, the client went over to him, said, what's up? He says, had some health issues and, I've got too many other properties. I don't have the people to support it. So if you just, foreclose on me or if I give you a deed, just write off the rest of the note and take the property. That's what's being worked in and they expect to sell the property afterwards, after he gets it into his name because he doesn't, he really doesn't want his IRA doing the, renting it and putting it in there, and that's his choice. But, he could just keep it and rent it. But he said he's going to go sell it because why not get, why not almost double his money right away?
This is actually a great example. Usually, most times, I'm telling stories to other people about loans that I have in process with some of my clients, and I'm paying these people back, so we never get into the other side of the coin where the property's going back. So here's a great example for somebody. It's like, here, shit hit the fan. This guy can't make the payment, right? Everybody wonders, I'm going to self-direct my IRA, and oh, my God, they're going to stop paying. But here, this guy did things right on the front end. You talked about not putting the money into a deal, Carl, unless it was secured correctly with the proper paperwork and recorded. So let's talk about a few of the things this guy did right. First, he only lent. He understood the values in the area, and his loan to value was 60%. So he made sure that he was at a certain threshold where if he did have to take the property back, he would be in a position that he should be able to profit once this whole thing, the dust settles and he sells the property. There should be additional money, and he should almost have, certainly break even if the condition of the property is, a little rough. He should certainly break even, if not make out better than if he would have just collected the regular loan payments until it was paid off. Am I kind of understanding that the right way, Carl?
No, you're handling it exactly correctly because people ask, what's the worst thing that can happen here? And I tell them the people stop paying and you don't get your money. And then they say, well, what's the best thing that can happen to you? The people stop paying, you don't get your money, you foreclose, and you get twice as much.
Yeah, you know, we're making a little light of it. I'm sure that this client's stressed out about it, and he didn't want to deal with
it. He's not stressed out about it at all because it's in his backyard, and he owns other properties. So he's ecstatic about it. Yeah, I mean, you know, he was a little bit shaken up when he wasn't getting the payments, but now he says, hey, let's do this, and the borrower is on board with it, so they don't even have to go to court with it. So it you know, it makes it easy. But I've seen other ones where they've gone to court, you know, and foreclosed for $3,000 or $5,000 and then sold the property and made more than if they had just been paid back. And obviously all that money comes in, doesn't get taxed, and you can put it right back out on the street, and you're making more with it now. So in the long run, I just think it's great. I don't worry about it as long as the value in the property stays where it is. And guess who sets those terms up? The IRA client. You know, you don't only want to lend at 50% loan to value, then only lend at 50. If you want to lend at 60 or 70, you know, and then say, well, it cost me $5,000 to foreclose, then, you know, it's not that much. But I do want to bring up another point, too. There's people out there that don't have a whole lot of money, or there's people that are trying to get into business, I mean, into the real estate business. And I don't expect them to go buy their first house if they've never really done it before. But there's a lot of mentors out here that charge them thousands of dollars. And this is just one of the little tricks that I've seen other clients use, is they'll take their IRA money, they'll find the best rehabber in their area through their real estate investment club or going around talking to people and looking at stuff, and they'll find a great rehabber. And guess what? Most rehabbers always need to borrow money. So what they'll do is they'll lend their money to the best rehabber that they know. The rehabber is going to let them come in and do inspections, you know, for the different draws during the time, and almost be a mentor, because as a lender, you get a lot of the insight into what's going on. So you basically learn a lot by lending money, and if you do that once or twice or three times, and then you want to go into rehabbing, you've got that experience behind you. You've seen it. You've seen their crews. You've seen how they've done contracts. You see the type of work that the crews have done. Before people pay for a mentor, you know, that's 1,000 miles away, look in your own backyard and see if you want to lend money to somebody that's doing this and has been doing it. Does that make sense, Dan?
That's a great point. I mean, the local experienced investors who have been in and out of settlements profitably over a course of years, especially if they've been in, you know, through the tumultuous times like 2008, 9, and 10, you're going to get an invaluable amount of experience by being a lender. If you want to be, you know, involved on the deal and figure out what the numbers were and how much the construction costs and take a few tours of the property, one way to get the undivided attention of somebody like that, I mean, because these rehabbers, you got to understand, these people are super busy. You know, people approach me, I don't have time to, like, you know, handhold and stuff unless it's like somebody who's intimately involved on my team and getting the deals done. It's just the reality of, you know, how busy people become. And being a lender on a deal, like you just said, I mean, that's a great way to get a foot inside the door, Carl. What would be the documentation, if you could just list off simply, that, like, somebody who is going to lend and kind of run the mini bank IRA scenario, I mean, at a minimum, what should these people have their attorney draw up or make sure is being signed and recorded on a deal?
Well, I mean, they can go on to Cameron Plan's website and do a lending checklist, I think, and find the checklist there. But one is they should have a note, right, which is signed. They should have a mortgage and or a deed of trust, depending on what state you're in, that outlines the terms and conditions of the mortgage and the property that it's on, et cetera. They should understand what the exit strategy is if they're going to do that loan. Is it a short-term loan for the rehab and the seasoning? Is it going to take a year or 2 years? Are they going to sell the property to a homeowner at the end? Are they going to refinance out of it and then keep it as an investment property? Those types of things need to be looked at. The other one that a lot of people make a mistake on is not using title work, right? Make sure the people you're lending the money to own the property and find out what position you're going to be in. You know, are you in first position? Is there any liens in front of you? Is there another mortgage in front of you? Do you have the equity in the place that you think you're going to have? You know, that's a couple of the things that I think each loan needs to go through. And the attorney should also be looking at it, you know, for any peculiarities in a special area. Do they have insurance, as an example? And is that insurance making the mortgagee the IRA so that if the place burns down or floods, the money is returned to the IRA and not to the owner of the house? First, that mortgage is paid off, and then the rest goes to them. You know, without going into all of those details, a title company and or lawyer should at least address those points.
Nice. Spot on.
Yeah. And so, I'll just give you another example. I mean, we had one person that did the note and the mortgage, right? They did it off of Office Depot's notes and mortgages. The borrower brought it in, they signed the note, and then the borrower told the client, you know, we don't need a title company, I'll go record the note. And then the borrower never recorded the note. Trying to save that stuff, and that goes back to your issue where you trusted them. This person, in my opinion, trusted them too much. Hey, that's all right, but everybody else in the world uses title companies and has a third party record it just so that everything is good. So if it ever does go to court, you did everything the way you're supposed to.
So if you're a lender on the line right now and you're taking notes like I am, you want to write down to use a title company anytime you're going to fund a deal. And I guess they could have the IRA, what, send a check right out to the title company in order for a disbursement? Is that like a safeguard there a little bit?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely a safeguard, right? I mean, people try to do notes, you know, unsecured with us. And they say, well, you know, I'm going to give him the money. He's going to give me the note. And I say, yeah, but what happens then if, you know, he doesn't give you the note and we're wiring money into his bank account? Have him give you the note first so that we have it here and he signed it, because once we send the money, we can't get it back. So that's kind of what we do in our office. If somebody has an unsecured note, we need the note signed off before we'll release the money.
Yeah, and I've actually done that with you guys, so I know that's definitely the operating procedure. Carl, let's switch gears here a little bit. I've heard some rumors about creating tax-free income for life utilizing IRAs. Is this bullshit, or is this something that can be done?
No. I mean, like I alluded to it a little bit earlier, I've got a Roth IRA, you know, and I just turned 59 and a half last year. So that rent can come in. I've got a house that's in a Roth IRA. That rent comes in, and I can take it out, you know, 2 seconds later, and I don't pay any taxes on that. And guess what? When I die, my kids will be able to do the same thing. And when they die, it can go to my grandkids. Or maybe I'll just skip my kids and give it right to my grandkids. And then and then they can use it for what they want, and they can send it to another generation. Because I do like my grandkids a lot better than my kids. I'm only kidding you. But basically that's all tax-free money that's coming in and going out. And somebody says, well, what happens if the IRS changes their rules and regulations? I said, that's a good reason to get into the Roth IRA now, because at any time you can take your contributions out without any tax penalties, whether you're 59 and a half or not. And if you're at 59 and a half and your IRA is 5 years old, you can take everything out at that point tax-free. And I think they're going to grandfather Roth IRAs in place. If they ever do get rid of them, they won't, you know, they'll probably just do like they do with Social Security and say, hey, nobody can have them anymore.
Yeah, because a significant portion of the affluent population would be up in arms, nearly grabbing pitchforks if that were the case, right, Carl? If they took
grandfather in. Yep, and the middle class, you know.
Yeah, got it. I know we kind of touched on it a little bit, but I do want to let's talk about the process. We talked about the mini bank situation. Let's now talk about, you know, how did you put that property you talked about in your own Roth IRA? I mean, how did you go about buying that? Let's talk about the management structure. You know, how are the rents being paid? Is the tenant mailing it directly to, you know, the custodian, to CAMA? I mean, can we kind of like go into the details about the IRA actually owning real estate, Carl?
Sure. The house was bought back in 2007. It was an impulse buy. I made a mistake on it, and we paid $330,000 on it. At one point, it got down to where the value of it was, you know, it was in Florida. It's on the water, two blocks from the ocean on a deep water canal close to the inlet. And the value went down to $150,000, you know, was where it was. So at that point, I converted the house to a Roth IRA. I actually put a loan on it and then converted it to a Roth IRA so that I would pay even less taxes. And we can talk about that at another time. So I paid the taxes on that money, expecting it to appreciate, and it is appreciating to some extent at this point. But now the rent comes in, right? And as you asked, the tenant sends it right to the custodian because I took out a loan on it. Part of that rent then goes and pays off the loan, and the rest is available for me to take out. But for the most part, I take that money and reinvest it, or I pay down the loan. Because I think the loan's at, you know, like 5%, and I don't make any money on it pretty much in the IRA. So if I pay down the loan, then I'm making 5% on that money is the way I look at it. And the tenants keep putting the money in there, and if I need to fix something, then I call up a plumber or an electrician or whoever it is, somebody to clean it, and I call up the custodian, send them the invoice, and say pay it. And the bill gets paid, you know, pretty simple from that aspect. And the Florida properties are renting, you know, for the past 5 or 6 years. By the time one person moves out, I think it might be 3 or 4 days before the next one's in there.
Do you have sailboat access in that canal?
Oh, yeah. Sailboat access, deep water canal. Yeah.
Sweet. So the next question that brings up, that's a very interesting one with the single family house that you then converted to the Roth IRA. I got to know all the details. I mean, you initially bought this in your own name?
No, no, you can't do that. No, I bought it in the IRA.
Okay, so you bought it in an IRA.
In a traditional IRA.
Okay, bought it in a traditional IRA and then put a loan on the property. Where did the loan come from?
With a non-recourse loan, IRAs can do non-recourse lending or take a non-recourse loan, and there's 3 or 4 or 5 banks that are very good at it in the country, and they do them nationwide. I'll give a little plug for North American Savings Bank, and you might even want to bring Matt Allen on and do an interview with him, and he can give you the details of how they lend to IRAs, and he's probably been in the business the longest of any of the people that are out there, and he can talk about all those details. But basically, you know, being in the business, I know the people and know the rules associated with it. So there was a non-recourse loan. I think it was 70% loan to value. I think we might have even got it lower than that. I just wanted to cut it down because I didn't want to let's just say it was $150,000 the house was worth. So the loan, I think, was for like $75,000. And then when I converted it, I only had to pay on the value of the house that I owned at that point, which was $75,000. So this house that I'd put up for $330,000 is now I'm paying taxes on $75,000, and I'll start paying down that loan of $75,000. And when it gets back to $300,000 or $400,000, that'll all be tax-free.
Nice.
And like I said, if you need to, we can get a couple of people that do loans for that. And a lot of times people know their banks, and then we explain to them what it is, and some local banks will do it for, you know, because they want to try it out and see what it is. But the banking industry has gotten so skittish. You know, after 2008, it's been harder to find more banks that will do that.
Is it easier to get an acquisition loan or do a refinance and back into the IRA with the money? I mean, what's the smoothest sailing course of action for obtaining financing like this on a property?
I don't think it really matters, but I think the acquisition is the way to go. Do it right from the beginning if you need it for it from that aspect. It just saves you the headache of going back into it and, you know, doing another closing and sometimes you know, depending on what state you're in, when you put a mortgage on it, you've got other costs that are associated with it. So if you tie it all in at the acquisition, I think it's cheaper overall.
Got it. And then do you have a property manager in place on that, or what would be the rules on a house like this in regards to property management?
Well, what happens on that is mostly all the rents go into the IRA. We give the tenant a list of, you know, we give them a plumber if there's anything wrong with the plumbing, anything, you know, an electrician, a handyman is pretty much what they have. And they can call them up and do it. And then I've got a relationship with them and they call me and I say, yeah, go over and do it. And they pretty much know after working with me that that's the way it is. And then they also will send a bill to the IRA that I'll sign off on and then they'll get paid. I do have a realtor sometimes that goes in and will rent it for me. Other times the tenant going in there will also say, hey, there's other people here, you know, and there's this for rent sign in the garage there that they put out, you know, 60 days before they're going to move out, if they're going to move out. And, you know, it just seems to, you know, that's from years and years of working. We figured out how to minimize the amount of time and energy for that. And I do have the property with a property manager, you know, if something comes up and I'm out of the country or something.
You'd also mentioned in the healthcare and education. Could we talk a little bit about the programs or the parameters of self-directing a healthcare savings account, and also which education account would be able to self-direct?
Yeah, it's a covered all educational savings account is for the education, and people should write that down. And then the health savings account, which is tied to a high deductible insurance policy. They've been around since 2006, but most people didn't start getting into them until 2010 because nobody knew what all the rules were, et cetera, after Congress passed the laws. A little bit like Obamacare. Nobody's really sure of all that stuff today. But, you know, in a few years, we'll actually understand it. But the health savings account, you know, and I'll give you a personal example. My wife and my insurance used to be $14,000 a year. When we first got on the health savings account, it was $7,000 a year. We got a high deductible health care plan. We had to pay the first $5,000 of the bills, you know, as a deductible. So that was very easy for me to look at. My insurance premiums are $7,000. My deductible is $5,000. So I'm out $12,000 where my premiums were $14,000. I still had copays and deductible with that. So I was saving $2,000 right off the top when they first came out or when I first got it. And then I got a deduction on the $5,000 deductible that I put into my, because I would put $5,000 into my HSA, so that was already a deductible, and I could take it out any time for medical expenses and pay for it. So I automatically saved basically another $2,000 or 40% on the $5,000 that I put in there, and then I could use it. So the deduction was there, so I'm already up $4,000, and then I said, well, let's see what happens with this. But then when I went in to do some medical stuff with my wife, I had, in some cases, a less payment for the whole thing than some people were doing with their copays. So I was just winning all the time with this stuff. And what I ended up doing was, because once you get on Medicare, you can no longer make contributions to it. So I never would spend my HSA money that I put into this account. I only started, you know, building it up, and we put in, you know, approximately when it first started out, I think $5,000 or $6,000, because myself and my wife were over 55. You get a little boost in how much you can put into it. And I think last year we were able to put $8,600 into it. And then you go and you know, put that money, you know, hook it up with an IRA and your HSA together, and then make a loan out there. But now we've got enough in just the HSAs together, you know, with the past, I don't know, 6 or 7 years, we've got $50,000 that we can lend out, like you were talking about, on a rehab at, you know, 12 or 15%, you know, for a year. And we can do that all the way to the time we get on Medicare, which I don't know what we're going to do when we get to that age, but it just seems like it's great. And once I do get on Medicare, I can use that money in that account to pay whatever the government isn't paying. And if you talk to the older people now, they're getting less and less from Medicare than they used to. And they've got another policy, and we're probably going to run a class at our academy just to go over all the Social Security and Medicare and how complicated it's gotten, you know, tied in with Obamacare, so somebody can, you know, help us make decisions on that.
Nice. I mean, you also kind of, I know we started to touch on this and then I changed directions a little earlier in the episode here, but somebody with a small amount or even these HSAs, I mean, if I put, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 grand, or I had an IRA with 10 or 15 or 20 grand in it, what type of options have you seen people, you know, invest in who have IRAs that are in the seed stage like that, Carl?
There's a couple things. One, I've seen them take their IRAs, HSAs, and a couple of those things and put them together and build more money. I've seen them partner with other people's IRAs, then go into a deal together. I've also seen people put some money down on an option to buy a house, as an example. You know, let's say the house is worth $100,000. You're getting it at $80,000. And you only have $20,000 in your IRA, you put an option on the house, you know, to buy it at $80,000, or you put a contract in to buy it at $80,000. You've got 20. So what you do is you go over and you sell half of that contract, you know, for $50,000 because the house is worth $100,000 or 60% of the house. And you, at that point, take $60,000 from the person that has it. You put in $20,000, and now you've got 40% of the house for only 20% of the money. So you've pretty much doubled your money at that point in time, and you've got the house sold. Or you can sell half of it for, you know, $60,000 if somebody wants it.
So you've seen people actually do it like that, huh?
Yeah, absolutely.
What about assignments of contract? I mean, if somebody were to do an assignment transaction, is that something that the IRA could somehow be the buyer on, Carl?
Sure. I'll give you an example. There was a woman who opened up an account, saw a building that she wanted to buy. Kate was her name. And this was actually, I believe, in Cranberry, New Jersey. And she put, I think, what she put down on, like $3,000 on the building. She gave us a $5,000 or $4,000 contribution. And this was back, you know, a number of years because she needed to get the account open and she couldn't get the money from Fidelity fast enough to sign the contract. But she put her transfer in, you know, for $350,000 or $300,000 to come over to us, made her contribution for that year and put that down on the contract and then said, hey, we'll close in, you know, 90 days or something like that. And she started doing her inspections and title work, and the guy doing the inspection, I believe it was, offered her $350,000 for the property.
Nice.
Right. So she thought about it and she said, yeah, I make $50,000. She only had $3,000 invested in it at the time. And then the attorneys got in there and, you know, they were going to do a simultaneous closing in 90 days. But then one of them said, well, you know, is there anybody that has a problem with just assigning the contract? And the seller didn't have a problem with it. So they just assigned the contract and she got her $50,000 plus the $3,000 down. You know, and she did that in 9 months. So there was $3,000 that turned into $50,000. So yeah, it does happen out there, and I would call that a home run. But you know, that's an actual example of how a deal can go by. You know,
and then it's like a 1,700% return.
Yeah, right, something like that. I mean, it's astronomical. But you can't go to Christmas parties and tell people that's the types of returns you're making, because then they just think you're crazy.
Yeah. You can't share that outside the real estate circles, right?
Not really. Even with the real estate circles, you know, everybody's used to making 15 or 20%. They're not.
Well, Carl, this is one of my favorite questions. I've been able to gain so many great book recommendations. And that's like one of the things I do that I notice a lot of other successful people do is they read books, a lot of interesting takes on a lot of interesting topics. And I've watched my own life change as a result of making a habit. Whenever anybody gives me a book recommendation, I don't go read the summary and I don't think in him and haul on it. I buy the book immediately. I'll give you a quick example of my own story. So just the other day I was in Florida with one of my partners and he gave me a book recommendation and we were like sitting at a traffic light and he thought I was texting and I was actually in the Amazon app completing the purchase for the book. I said, done. Just so you know, that it is partially a lesson in like removing the procrastination. For me though, that habit is priceless. I mean, I don't know if you have the same experience or not, but I guess I'll ask you the question. Do you have any book recommendations for me and our listeners, Carl?
I'll give you a couple. You know, they're oldies but goldies, I think, and you've probably already read them, but one of my favorites is Think and Grow Rich. I think your mind and your brain is probably the best asset that you've been given in life, and I think that Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill is a good book, and I'll recommend that. I also like Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. Technology changes, but a lot of the points he's making in the book will be with us for generations, if not centuries. And then I'll give you one more because we talked a lot about the Roth IRA, and you were kind of interested in how to do that. And this book actually saved me tens of thousands of dollars and got me thinking about the one house that was converted to the Roth. And that's a book called Keep It, K-E-E-P-I-T, by Joe Luby. And Luby is L-U-B-Y. You know, if you can pick up a, you know, $15 book and it saves you 10 grand, what's the return on that since you like to do those?
Yeah, it's even better than the cranberry deal, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So I have one more question here before we get wrapping up. Do you have any final jewels of wisdom to share with our listeners, Carl?
Yeah, what I would say is, you know, take control of your financial future because nobody watches your money better than you do. And from my experience with other people, and I mean professionals, you know, doctors, lawyers, dentists, a whole variety of professions said, hey, I was out there learning my job. I thought my financial advisor was taking care of me, but you have to keep your hand in your financial future. So I would say, you know, take control of it, get a self-directed IRA. And if you don't want to do that, at least meet with your financial advisor and be involved in the decisions going forward. And then if you are doing that already, make sure you do your due diligence. You talked about having trust with who you do business with and, you know, who you lend money to. You should feel that all the way around. And I think you should feel that way. If you use CAMA Plan, then we should make you feel comfortable. We put a due diligence page on our website. And everybody should be doing that and working with people that you trust and that you like. And don't ever fall for somebody that says this deal's going to be gone. I've been around long enough to know there's always another deal coming down the road. So I hope that helps your clients.
Where's the wisdom? Absolutely. So you mentioned a couple of resources. I want you to touch on all those before we wrap up here so that if anybody's interested, you know, what can they find on your website and how can they get in touch with CAMA Plan in order to move forward with you guys, Carl?
They can call us at 866-559-4430, 866-559-4430. They can always email us at info@camaplan.com, and they can go onto our website, camaplan.com. It's won a lot of awards. It's pretty easily looked at. There's a lot of free information there. There's recorded webinars. There's the live registrations for upcoming events. There's different information on the different accounts, contribution levels. There's information on myself. You can look me up, et cetera, and Maggie on LinkedIn, as well as our website. So it's got a lot of information there, and I would just ask people to take a look at it if they're considering how to do a self-directed IRA. We'll be glad to talk to you. And if you don't get the answers from the people in the office, you can always set up an appointment to talk to me.
You had mentioned a few of the resources, I think, were the lending checklist.
Oh, yep. The private lending checklist is in there. Pretty much anything, there's articles in there, the lending checklist, the frequently asked questions. You know, I should have brought up the website so that I could go through everything that's there. But once you go there, it's pretty easy. And if you type in a word, you know, one of the things that are over there will help people look at the different resources, because a lot of their financial advisors or accountants will tell them that IRA investing is not legal, it's risky and it's complex, and we kind of go through those arguments with them. We know it's legal, it's on Bloomberg, and there's articles in Wall Street Journal, and there's, you know, dozens and dozens of books on them at this point in time. It's risky, but it's, you know, like we talked about earlier, it's not risky if you're investing in what you know and understand. And if it's complex, we're here to help you through it step by step. So I guess that would be another word of wisdom. But look at the website. I think, you know, every time somebody asks us a question, we put, you know, we make a page and answer it for them. So I think they should find everything they need right there.
Well, I appreciate you giving of your time. I know you're super busy, you know, running things over there at Cam and Carl, and I really appreciate you coming on the show to share with my audience all this wonderful stuff about self-directed IRAs and how to avoid paying taxes here.
Yep. No, I appreciate you having me on here, and I really enjoyed the time with you.
And thank you, my loyal REI Diamonds listener, for tuning in to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Do you have investment capital which is not currently earning a high rate of return? Would you like to schedule a time with me personally at no cost to discuss options which might be available to you right now to place that capital into high-performing assets? You can contact me directly by visiting www.reidiamonds.com and clicking the Contact Dan link at the top of the page. Are you interested in receiving a notification when I release the next REI Diamonds episode? You can either sign up for email at www.reidiamonds.com or subscribe through one of the podcasting apps, including iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. If you are interested in buying a deal from me or selling a deal to me, please visit www.reidiamonds.com and click the appropriate link at the top of the page. I am currently personally buying deals in Philadelphia, New Jersey, Delaware, Maryland, Chicago, Atlanta, Colorado, and the Tampa Bay region in Florida. Did you enjoy this episode? I hope you did. Maybe you might know somebody else who would also enjoy the episode. If you forward this episode to them, I'm sure they'll thank you later. Plus, I appreciate the referrals, and I appreciate you, my loyal REI Diamond Show listener. Dan Breslin here. I will catch you on the next episode.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.